Welcome to the Mumbrella Podcast, brought to you, as usual, from the studios of CBS Interactive. I'm Tim Burrows. This week, we chat to KidsCo TV Managing Director Paul Robinson about Generation Multitask. In digital, Telstra explains why it pulled the plug on its Second Life. And Google rakes in the cash again. In radio, we say goodbye to Vega and hello to classic rock. The Battle of Big Thinking, reports from the Brainiac front line. Also, we ask, are Aussie brands failing to make the most of their digital newsrooms? And new lifestyle website cherry-picked, hit or miss? Joining me as usual, Mumbrella Deputy Editor Camille Alacon.
Hello.
Scott Rohde of PR agency House Party.
Hey, Tim.
And our guest for the week, friend of the podcast, Paul Robinson, Managing Director of KidsCo.
Great to be back, thank you.
So, Paul, yeah, welcome back. Now, this week, you one of the many things you did, you were here for the Astra conference, but you also gave a speech about technology creating this new generation. I think you called it Generation MT. What did you mean by that?
Well, the hypothesis was this, really, and that is that if you think back to when you were a child, you know, if you misbehaved, you know, what your mum or your dad would do was say, you know, go to your room, and you know, that was designed to be punishment, you know, deprivation. But of course, now if you send a child to their room, they've got television, they've got their MP3 player, they've got their mobile phone, they're probably online on their computer. So, you know, children's bedrooms these days are an Aladdin's cave of technology. So go to my bedroom, mum, no problem at all. And the point I was making really was thinking about television and linear television. Is linear TV going to eventually be dead as a medium? And if so, when's that going to happen and what's it going to be replaced by? And what's very interesting is some new stats by Nielsen in the US that have just come out show that although children are actually watching less TV than they were, they're now spending a lot more time on digital video delivered online, all the other technology we just talked about. And in fact, overall, they're spending more time with technology, more time with media than they were 10 years ago. And how can that be? Because there's only 24 hours in a day and kids have to go to school. And essentially what's happening is there's just much more multitasking going on. Kids are just great at doing this, you know. And classically, you know, a child will be online, they'll be listening to music, they'll be watching the TV and still claim to do their homework.
And is there a social process, a social part to it as well? So, for instance, if they're watching television, are they also talking about it with their friends online? So are they sharing the experience, or is it literally something completely different they're doing?
Well, I think there's also this perception of children that they've lost the ability to talk to people because they're spending all their time on social networking sites and aren't actually able to converse, you know, one-to-one. And I think the evidence is actually that's untrue. What they're actually doing is they're using technology to converse, and they're probably sharing their thoughts, whether they're about TV or anything else in their lives, as much or more than we as adults do. It's just the perception is that because it's a different world, adults don't get it. And I think children actually are very much using TV as a general currency for their lives.
It's really interesting. The other day when I was at AdTech, someone, one of the speakers said, it isn't so much that they're multitasking, they just flip from one device or one channel from the other just really quickly. So I don't know if there's actually a difference between multitasking, maybe it is multitasking still per se.
I guess that's right. I mean, I guess the question is how much is happening simultaneously and how quickly are they flicking? And I think you're absolutely right that kids can flick from one thing to another very, very fast and it doesn't faze them at all. I mean, you just see how a young person or a child will actually use even a remote on a TV. They're much quicker about choosing what they want and they can flick through a whole range of channels and quickly make a decision and say, I'm going to go for that one. Mm. Whereas an adult goes, hey, slow down, let me see what's going on. So I think it's probably a combination of both. I think you're right.
And what does it maybe mean for print as a medium, for instance? Because something like magazines or newspapers is very hard to multitask with. Does that mean they've an opportunity because they have this attention span when people are consuming them, or actually does it kind of lock them out to Generation MT?
I think that kids just don't really think of newspapers and the physical printed word as being significant to them as being online. You know, they expect to get all that information actually on a screen. They don't particularly think of newspapers as being a medium of choice or indeed magazines. And I think that probably those media are going to decline even faster with kids than they are already with adults. I mean, the indications are that the newspaper industry is heavily challenged and may probably eventually become an online medium totally. So I think they're not part of their thinking. The other one is radio too. I mean, radio is actually a difficult medium for young people and is definitely losing traction. You know, they see it as audio delivered, you know, online. They don't necessarily see it as being a linear radio station in a sequence. That's just not the way they think about it.
They can choose what they want.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I almost wonder with radio whether one of the opportunities for radio is, and again, this I guess one of the things that sort of provoked my thinking was both ad tech, which we'll talk about a bit later, and also Battle of the Big Thinking that we'll talk about later, is this idea that discovery is going to become increasingly important as more information, more music comes through, and whether that's radio's opportunity to kind of reconnect is actually being a discovery medium for people wanting to find new music.
Well, certainly when I was young, I used to use the radio that way. You know, I'd listen to, you know, Radio 1, for example, in the UK, which is a station that's got a good mix of new music as well as familiar music. And that was the basis on which you then went and bought a song, you went and bought a record, I mean, a physical record in those days. And you hear it on the radio, and you have a DJ who basically you trusted because you had a relationship with that DJ. That DJ recommended some music to you, you played it on the radio, and you thought, hey, that's great. And then you went and bought it. So much radio now is moving to become the familiar or segmented formats where you choose a particular format. I do think there's an issue about how you get exposed to new music. Somehow you've got to have radio stations which are multi-formatted.
Well, we'll talk radio formats a little bit later on. Now, one of the things that brings you to Australia is the Astra Conference, which is the conference of the subscription television industry. Now, the panel that you were brought in on was the disconcertingly vague content is king. And I guess the position you're coming from is talking about the importance of content to a channel like KidsCo, where you've got to persuade people that it's worth subscribing to.
Well, I think the big challenge in Australia is you've got three big buckets of funding for television. You've clearly got the free-to-air networks, which are very powerful still, complaining and bleating, but getting good subsidies from the government, some might argue unfair subsidies. You've got the ABC, who are getting more money, and more money for children's as well, and appear to be pretty well funded in maybe a tough economic time.
Terrible time to launch KidsCo then, wasn't it?
Well, no, not at all. And then you've got the subscription television industry. Now, my point of view is this, that I think subscription TV is incredibly good value. I think the offer that Foxtel and Oster have in Australia is extremely good value. But there's clearly a lot more work to be done to persuade people that indeed is the case. And when you say pay for television, there is some resistance from some people. They don't understand why they should pay for television. They think advertising-funded TV is free. They think the ABC is free. Both, of course, are not free, but they perceive them to be free. And that's the challenge. And no, the reason for launching KidsCo at a similar time to the ABC was actually to ensure there was a balance. It was to ensure that Foxtel and Austar did have something new to say, had some new content, had some new reasons for people to subscribe, whilst ABC was upping its game as well.
And KidsCo, not just in this market in Australia, but also in the UK, for instance. How actually is it going as a business?
Well, we're growing very fast. I think when I was here last time, we had about 60 countries. We're now up to 83. In 18 languages, so we're growing very rapidly indeed with some big new launches later on this year, including South Africa and Italy and Malaysia, so we continue to grow. As far as Australia is concerned, we're new. You know, we launched in November. We'll get our first rating numbers in the next few weeks, which would be both exciting and scary, but fingers crossed, I think we should do well. We've had very good response. I mean, the website is generating about a third of a million hits a month. We're running competitions and getting about 6,000 entries a month from people. So kids are watching. You know, we think it's a good start, but obviously with the new guys, and we're going to build from here.
Okay. Now, as I've been saying, it's a big week for conferences. So AdTech, which focus on the digital advertising industry, Camille and myself are both there. Camille, you're...
Scott was there as well.
Scott, you popped in, did you, Scott?
Yeah, I was there, yeah.
Oh, good of you to join us. I don't think I passed across at all.
No, I was quite delighted about that.
No, I think I saw him running away from you when he saw you.
Yeah, that was probably it. So, Camille, your overall impressions, first of all.
I suppose, you know, as journalists, for one, we go to a lot of conferences, so slightly cynical about it all. At the end of the day, I think the content is all a bit much of a muchness, but there were some interesting discussions, especially not least because of apparently it's the year of the mobile, guys, if you haven't heard from every year.
Since 2001, year of the mobile.
I mean, from a consumer perspective, there's no doubt about that. I don't think marketing, I actually joined one of the sessions regarding mobile marketing, I wasn't convinced it was the year of the mobile in terms of mobile marketing, but absolutely it's all about the consumer. And the only thing that I find with some of these conferences is you've got 5 minutes for a Q&A at the end of a session, and it's almost as though, actually, you know what, maybe we should be more integrated within the conversations instead of being talked at for half an hour for 40 minutes.
Yeah, that's the format we chose for our Digital Citizens event, which was more audience participation, because I feel that that's what I thought that as well. I got to, two people got to ask a question each, and that was it. And I was like, well, you know,
because there were some great speakers.
Yeah, there were great speakers, and they're the people you want to pick their brains with, and you didn't get that opportunity. And I just felt it was a really missed opportunity.
Okay, well, let's cover a few of the topics briefly. So, standalone campaigns are dead. That was one of the provocative topics that that you covered, Camille.
Yeah, Dale Cohen, GM of Big Pond Online Network, and Nick Hodges.
Yeah, from Clemenger.
Surname with Clemenger Digital CD. They both pretty much said this: the idea of the standalone campaign is dead, in that you launch a big above-the-line campaign and go, okay, that's it, and moving on to the next one. Because basically what you need to do now in this day and age with brands is continue the conversation. So basically what they're saying is not that brands are doing that, but more brands should do that if they want to kind of continue to engage with consumers through social networking, for example. So even if you launch a social networking-led campaign, don't end it on the 31st of March when the campaign's over. Keep talking to them online.
That's nice of advertising to finally catch up with PR then.
Well, this was a sort of ongoing theme of the conference, because one of the sessions I covered had, in fact, Telstra all over the place, because I think they're in your session too.
Yeah.
But they talked about Second Life. And to begin with, the speaker was very much making the argument that, yes, it's like holding a party, and just as it's getting going at midnight, you kick everyone out. Until sort of a couple of awkward questions from the floor was like, well, didn't you close your Second Life site in December? And it didn't come up, but they, of course, closed the Telstra Now We Are Talking blog, which had obviously been quite controversial last year as well. But they're saying they've kind of learnt from that and go where the consumers are, and it just, the conversations weren't happening anymore on Second Life. Mm-hmm. Maybe brands had actually bought the hype, and that was why they're moving, moving their resources.
The same thing we said about MySpace. There's a lot of companies just moving out of MySpace as well now, because they realise it's not the area that they want to be in, because consumers aren't there
unless
anymore.
Arguably you want to talk about music or entertainment.
Exactly, and then mostly music. What I mean? Whereas people in entertainment are still going to using Facebook more so.
Paul, do you see brands buying digital hype? Last year, I guess it was about, or the year before was about Second Life. Do you see that occurring?
5 years ago.
Yeah.
I think, as you say, a lot of it is hype. At the end of the day, if you're going to communicate with the consumer, whether you're using above the line or PR or any of the other tools, it has to be a continuous conversation. You know, one-off campaigns are effectively not efficient, because a consumer expects a continuous dialogue. And you have to actually not only have continuous dialogue, but actually integrate all of the tools at your disposal, including digital. So I think, actually, this is right, but it's pretty much stating the obvious, I think. Mm.
Another topic that came up was best job in the world, which was Tourism Queensland's idea that you win the best job in the world. How much impact did that have from the other side of the world to you, Paul?
Oh, there was a lot of coverage in the newspapers, yeah. I mean, every paper was covering it, and this was presented as being the job, you know. This is the one dream job, you know. And, of course, Queensland, it seems incredibly idyllic, you know, if you're sitting in the UK on a snowy winter morning.
Mm. But I wonder, do you now look on it as something that happened rather than an ongoing conversation? When was the last time you heard about that?
Well, the last time I heard about it was when you reminded me today that we were going to talk about it. So, you know, it's not exactly, it was a bit of a push, you know, big sort of blur and then silence.
And Camille, what was said about that at the conference?
Well, that was one example that was put forward by Nick from Clemenger as example of, that was one great campaign, and let's all remember it was a multi-award winning campaign.
It was also a campaign that had a 1.2 million thrown at it. God, you find me anybody in PR advertising against 1.2 million thrown at it, and they'll be able to do an amazing job. Most of the the funds that we deal with in PR, I'm ranting now.
Okay.
God,
sorry. Get the soapbox,
it just
guys.
Annoys me, because it wins all these awards. Yeah, it's dead easy to win an award if you get 1.2 million and a great idea. Do you know what? Great ideas are when you manage a campaign with 15,000 and you get an amazing ROI. That's what a good campaign is. It's not throwing 1.2 million, which 400,000 for the campaign, plus a prize, plus 800,000 and above the line.
Is 1.2 million much in this day and age?
As for an online campaign.
It's a global budget.
I thought it was more integrated than just online.
And it was 800,000 for above the line, and then 400,000, I think, doing everything else.
That's
still a lot of money.
Yeah, it is, but
okay, well, lots to cover this morning, so we'll move on, but we'll stick with digital. Now, yet again, Google has found another way of making a little bit more money, this time in the form of a logo. So if you're using Google Maps and you might look at your local map and zoom in and you're where you might have seen before ATM marked, you could now see the bank's brand marked. So banks will pay, or whichever the brand is that might appear there, and they'll pay just like any other digital thing by a sort of CPM basis. So for every 1,000 views that get served, they'll pay for it. Good idea, Scott, do you think? Is it?
Good idea. I'm not quite sure how they'll work out the payment. What if I'm just scrolling across a page to find something? How does it know? Do I have to click on the ATM logo or something?
No, I think it's each time it's served on the page. So if that logo appears on the page, then that will count as...
Well, they're going to make an absolute fortune if there are people who use Google Maps to get their way around places. Personally, I think it's a great idea. I mean, if I'm looking for McDonald's and I pull up my Google Maps and there's a little M, I go, brilliant, it's the closest place, I'll go there. You know, if I need
I notice you tweet in great excitement about the likes of McDonald's. I noticed on your Twitter stream last night you were very excited that you'd found a 24-hour drive-thru.
Yeah, I was sorry for 24-hour Hungry Jack's. That was because I was drunk.
Well, I hope it wasn't a drive-thru then.
No. It's the one in South Dowling. It's just Hungry Jack's. You walk into it, it's fine. I live around the corner from it.
You clearly don't get out enough.
No, the problem is I'm out too much.
Oh, right. Okay. We eat too much McDonald's.
Yeah.
Well, let's get back to radio. So and niches, as we were talking about earlier. So the great baby boomer experiment has ended. DMG has killed Vega and replaced it with classic rock.
Well, as Big Kev used to say, I'm excited. Sydney's newest radio station is Classic Rock 95.3. 1-300-953-953 for your feedback. So you've got it on at the Big Wheels Cafe in Botany.
We have Maroon Always.
Hang on, you've got it on Always. It's only 17 minutes old, but thank you for your support. Sydney's Classic Rock 95.3 FM with Steve Earle.
Now, Paul, you used to run the BBC's Radio 1 in the UK. Reformatting a station to that extent is a pretty desperate measure, do you think?
Well, I guess this is a commercial station, and they've obviously decided they need to find a way to reinvigorate it. Now, what is not clear, I think, is the extent to which the format's changed and the extent to which the label on the door has changed. Classic rock sounds to me like a safer format. It sounds like they're going to go for more familiar, more big artists, you know, songs which are going to be instantly recognisable as opposed to playing maybe some more esoteric stuff. And that's a very safe and obvious thing to do if you're going to try and build ratings and therefore revenue, but it may not be the right thing for the audience.
So with your previous sort of programme controller hat on, what process do you go through to get to that point where you make a change as big as that?
Well, I mean, the key thing is to make sure you don't lose audience. Now, at the Radio 1 and the BBC, we actually wanted to lose audience because the issue then was the commercial sector were arguing that Radio 1 was too commercial. So by actually losing audience, the government believed the station had become more public service and less commercial, and therefore it was in our interest to actually do it badly to lose audience. This is clearly different in this situation.
But bring your audience younger as well, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, that's a continual problem because radio stations, you tend to get to sort of regard a radio station as your friend. And so radio stations naturally get older with time because the listeners stay with them and you get older and the station gets older. So you've got to make a concerted effort to actually abandon listeners at one particular end and bring in new listeners all the time. And that's a hard thing to do.
Camille?
Well, I mean, one, I would agree with you. There's a presumption that the old Vega listeners are going to stick around for a classic rock, which is quite different, a different proposition, really.
No, baby boomers and classic rock are kind of similar to me.
Oh.
I think so. I
mean, does everyone like rock then?
I've seen that most of the baby boomers that I know are rock fans.
Do you like rock?
I'm not a baby boomer, back off.
Well, I guess that's one of the things. Is baby boomers, I get the impression that baby boomers don't tend to define themselves as baby boomers. So it's one of those kind of labels that marketers might quite like, but does it mean very much?
I don't think it means very much, and I haven't heard it again for a long time until I walked into your studio. I think that it is probably oversimplifying things to say that baby boomers just like classic rock. You know, there's clearly a segment who will. And if we're talking about, you know, Alice Cooper and Black Sabbath and Deep Purple, stuff like that, I can understand that.
Fun enough, Alice Cooper has a syndicated show as part of the lineup.
There you go. I suspect that there's also an appetite for new music too. I think nobody who's a real music fan wants to be sort of caught in aspic. You always want to hear new stuff as well as the stuff you love, and I think that might be the downfall there.
And I suppose the other question I had for myself was, and they did give it a good go and they stayed with it for a long time, but I just wondered whether sometimes, this is something you wrote about, Camille, this idea that you've got to stick with the format for a long, long time before people get used to it.
Yeah, I mean, I posed the question that perhaps, you know, it wasn't a case of not enough demand, but the niche was just too small for this market to sustain another player. So we've got Gold FM, we've got WSFM already. And for me, and this is just purely personal, I think there's much of a difference between the three of them. I didn't think either of them were any better, really.
Now,
they've been there longer.
One of the examples that Camille used in the piece that she wrote was Heart FM from the UK, where they just stuck with it and stuck with it and stuck with it, the same format, and just sneaked up, you know, half a ratings point at a time.
Well, Heart's success has been its consistency, actually, and they've now been in the market 10 years or so. They overtook Capital, who were the number one station in London, and Heart are now consistently, you know, right up there at the top. They've also rolled the station out around other metropolitan areas, and Heart's now quite a force. I mean, ultimately, it's quite a small playlist. You know, they play 600 songs, and they just play them over and over again, and if you like Michael Jackson or Candy Staten, that's absolutely fine, but it does get a bit boring.
It's always Young Hearts Run Free.
It's always Young Hearts Run Free from 1976.
Yes, with that DJ code of you never get tired of hearing that.
You don't.
Which means I hate having to play this all over again.
This is a good record, though. But not maybe every day.
Now, it seems like we've been doing nothing but conferences this week. But another industry gathering this week that was a little bit different was the Battle of Big Thinking, which was a really interesting idea. So 15 speakers, all trying to persuade the audience that they've got the biggest brain, three talking about each topic, each one only having 15 minutes, very strictly a countdown appearing beside the stage.
And this was the first as well, wasn't it?
So this was the first. So I was there for pretty much the whole event, which was quite a marathon, because obviously it was about sort of 5 hours. But you're right, it was a first. It was organised by the account planning group, which is sort of, you know, represents, I guess, the strategists within ad agencies, but tried for a much wider footprint, so that the idea being it wasn't just about agencies talking to agencies. So most of the speakers weren't from agency backgrounds, but there were some, you know, really interesting arguments made. So yeah, I mean,
did you like the most?
Who was the most exciting?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have agreed with the actual overall winner. So what they did was they had the five topics: so business, storytelling, advertising / marketing, media, and government and social. So you then voted a winner from each of those by text. And then you then had one overall winner. Now, in the end, the winner gave an absolutely bravura performance, a guy called Richard Sauerman. It was very much just around the idea of, hey, be brave, don't be mediocre. And it involved him kind of roaming the stage and shouting a lot. and it was all hosted by Julian Murrow from The Chaser. So he kind of made the point when he got off, you know, Richard's just about being able to overcome his crippling fear of social speaking. So I did think that in the end it was style won through. It was good content, but it was style. Mm-hmm. I actually would probably have chosen John Bradshaw, who's just leaving Virgin Mobile to take up with one of the beer brands, actually, who is just making the argument that the single most important thing to brands, when everything else is gone, when pricing differentiation is gone and we're all outsourced to call centres in India, or he's making the argument when Africa gets its act together, India will start looking too expensive for call centres. But when pricing is gone, branding differentiation is gone, the only thing that you'll have left is the brains of your top people and the talent of your top people and the management of your top people. So you shouldn't be handing that sort of management to the HR people, because it's too important to let them get their hands on it. You should be restructuring to make sure that your business is built, even if it means buying back 30% of the shares, so that you can motivate them better.
Okay.
So I guess, Paul, it's one of those cliches, isn't it? You know, people are your biggest asset. But annoyingly, it's kind of true as well.
I think annoyingly it is kind of true. I mean, we are, you know, in a sort of modern economy where, in fact, you can't really buy a bad car unless it's called Toyota.
And
most let's all calm down there, people.
Okay. Declaration of interest. Scott,
allegedly.
Yeah, well, declaration of interest. Scott does some of the digital PR for Toyota.
Okay, well, I'm sure Toyota's brilliant here in Australia. But, you know,
beer. No, 7 days without a crash. Sorry, that's mean.
that long. But beers, you know, most beers are good. There's not such thing as a bad beer, you know, and the traditional wisdom was, actually, the only way to differentiate was via marketing. Ultimately, it is about the best ideas and about innovating and driving forward. So it's right. This is my voice.
Well, no worries about that. Now, we've a lot to race through, so we'll race into yet another new subject again, which is Bessa Marstella did a survey this week, Camille, which you wrote about, which effectively is saying that Aussie brands aren't making the most of their engagement with consumers and with journalists in that when they put out press releases, they're not multimedia enough, I guess is the way of putting it.
I suppose they focused a little bit more on the corporate websites of companies. So they looked at the top 20 brands on the Interbrand list, and pretty much out of all of them, Telstra was the only one that stood out as a good example of having close to best practice. Okay, so I'm talking about having rich media, video, audio, extra information on their corporate website. I think it's probably an area that you don't really think as a really good PR front for your company.
We had a conversation about this, what rich media actually consists of, because everyone sort of defines it slightly differently. Now, Scott, let me bring you in as a PR practitioner.
Hello.
The digital press release. What really should it consist of?
There's a lot of different names for the social media release, digital press release, you know, all that kind of stuff. It depends on what information you've got and what information you need to send out.
What are the basics? What should you include?
You should contain the standard release, I suppose, or at least a few lines with quotes so journalists can then pick and choose what they want from it. An image or a video to back it up, if possible. Some sound clips, if possible, some little sound bites that they can just grab, if the radio can grab it, or if you want to run it on the website or something. And that's basically the gist of it, was what it should contain.
Well, you know, I think you're a bit ahead of some PR practitioners in that case.
Well, I mean, I was doing social media releases 4 years ago for Paramount Pictures. I mean, we sent out our releases, you know, contained links that you could then, they could then go bounce back and grab the trailer if they wanted it. It would contain everything they needed, basically. And, you know, that was the key to it. I just figured at that time, I based it on a US PR agency, whose name I've just forgotten, oh God, I'll remember and bring it up next week, but they launched their first social media release in 2004, and you know, the format they came up with then was as the format that should still be used today. It's a great format, mm-hmm. It's packed, and it's what it contains all the information that media need.
Okay, well, I want to zip through a couple more topics. New lifestyle website launched this week, Cherry Picked, which I quite like the name of. So that's the latest online guide, this time aimed purely at Sydneysiders. Camille, what do you think of it?
Yeah, so 18 to 39-year-olds, food, fashion, trends.
Your target audience?
Apparently. It seems to be a slightly younger feel than the Daily Addict, which...
Which is another Sydney website.
Carrie, yeah.
Carrie. Yes, that's right.
And Daily
yes, that's
Sydney. Right. I suppose for me... Now, she said that she identified a gap in the market. Now, I don't think anyone of us believes that. It's just another competitor, and who would you go for? This, for me, has a bit of a younger feel to it, even to a Daily Addict. And I don't know, I don't find the design and layout as kind of slick and arresting as a Daily Addict. So just in terms of looks to begin with, initially, I'm not really sold yet.
Well, I guess to start off with, it's a WordPress platform, isn't it? And then
absolutely,
the other debate
yeah.
is, does it really live and breathe as an email newsletter or as a website? And I think they'd make the argument that it's all about the daily newsletter,
I actually signed up to it as soon as I received the release, actually, out of interest, because I am the target market, and it hasn't really excited me.
Because I guess then it comes to the discovery, doesn't it? You're relying on them to find the hot new place.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the theme at the moment almost does seem to be discovery. Okay, well, Scott, gaps left in the market there, do you think?
I think there's always gaps in the market to be filled, and, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with this one.
Okay, well, look, finally, we always seem to finish this podcast talking about beer.
Yay!
So, I'm sure we all remember the banned Carlton Draft ads and all of our debate about what was behind it. Well, they finally got released to the public this week. Let's just take we'll take a very quick listen to what all the fuss has been about.
See that man driving his car right over a hill, right over a hill. It gave him a feeling right in his ghoulies. It's the Carlton Draft tingle, the Carlton Draft tingle. That tingle reminds him he's been working too hard to have a beer with his friends he hasn't seen for so long. It's the Carlton Draft tingle, the Carlton Draft tingle. Every man knows the Carlton Draft tingle. He knows the sign when it comes, the feeling in his man plums. Now he's tasting a delicious beer, brought to his attention by the Carlton Draft tingle. It's the Carlton Draft tingle, Carlton Draft tingle. Every man knows the Carlton Draft tingle.
Now, Camille, let's recap how we got to this point.
Basically, last month, there was supposed to be a trade briefing to unveil the new ad as part of the Made from Beer campaign, long-running campaign, successful executions such as Big Ad. And then in the last minutes, they decided basically
they decided to reschedule
the briefing to a yet to be confirmed future date.
But they were a bit honest, weren't they? Because normally in that sort of thing, they just sort of say, "Oh, sorry, slight delay." But they actually were quite upfront that they pulled it further.
I was like, "Why is this happening? You know, this is supposed to be the big unveil, big reveal for the big new ad." I said, "Well, basically." The ads were too risque, they went too far, and we're going to reshoot, we're going to go from start from scratch. And I'm like, really?
And
why are you telling me this? I'm a journalist.
Maybe they found a new brand of honesty out there.
Oh, that's what we thought, perhaps.
Well, at this point, now, cynics started saying it's obviously a plan to, in a week or two, leak it onto YouTubers. Here are the banned ads that are too hot for television. And sure enough, this week, the email came in saying, guess what you can find online?
Not quite on YouTube, but on an actual website. They've released seven new executions.
Yes, the website's called Any Excuse. Now, let's actually talk briefly about the ads themselves. So, Paul and Scott, you've both had a chance to look at them. Paul, what do you make of the ads? Would they sell beer to you?
I must admit, I was surprised at how risque they were. I mean, I can't quite believe that an ad for this execution would go all the way through a marketing department without them knowing they're going to get into hot water at the end. Yeah. I mean, that's just beyond belief.
I mean, there's one thing about an erection. I mean, really, at what point surely you go, don't know if this will make TV.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear there's going to be a problem with that, you know, wherever that's scheduled. I mean, to me, I think probably the cynical view is this seems like it's an attempt to make this brand seem really, really cool.
Yeah.
And it must have been a concerted effort. Now, I mean, yeah, there's no way that you'd be that open. If you generally screwed up and there hadn't been a proper process of approval, you'd try and cover that.
You see, really I have a slightly push. Different theory. My theory is that the agency was fully behind it, many of the people in the marketing department were fully behind it, and it was only when it got very senior, which is why there was maybe slightly more honesty, because there were people within the organisation who were trying to
That's possible, because I mean, some agencies are very persuasive, aren't they? And I mean, often you can find there are some really interesting creative agency ads made that maybe don't even work, but there's someone who's got carried along with the enthusiasm of the agency. So I think it's possible. I mean, any reasonably senior manager, though, not just the top manager, would think, ouch, this is going to be a problem. I mean, I think the alarm bells would have gone off earlier, I think.
And I suppose the second point that I'd make as well is the digital strategy then, which is to put them on this, you know, Any Excuse microsite, rather than out there in the wild on YouTube or Vimeo or anywhere else.
They'll probably end up on YouTube.
Well, yeah, but it'll be because somebody else rips them from there. It won't be under their own control. And to me, it just that against Maxford, they're not. You know, it feels like a digital strategy on the fly.
Yeah.
Where
like here we go, we've got it, but what do we do with it? And then we'll put it there, but we won't put it anywhere else. Realistically, what they should be doing is it should be on YouTube. They should have a Facebook page set up for it. You know, get people involved. Maybe see if people can come up with their own risky little songs or something like that. You know, that's what they should be doing to try and get people more engaged and get the conversation about it.
Well, maybe they're hoping it will go out organically rather than it being looking like a concerted campaign by management. They're hoping it might just sort of gradually eke out into the, you know, into the advertising system. And then the public will actually take it on, possibly.
Well, another beer which has been up to interesting stuff, Camille, has been 2E's, which has come up with, a new way of creating a 30-second ad.
Yeah, Lyle Nathan's Tui's Extra Jive. Basically, they launched a new campaign a few months ago called The Lab. And it was off the back of looking for an unsigned Australian artist or band to collaborate with Mark Ronson, the UK producer, on a new song. And the new song would be basically the ad, would be the track for a new TV ad. So they've just released it, and there's been some mixed responses to it, actually.
So the agency was BMF behind
BMF,
it,
yeah, the long-running agency for Tui's Extra Jive. And basically, the ad is 30 seconds of the clip, and then it points you to the website where you can download the song. So the idea is to drive people to actually get some airplay for the actual song. And I don't know, for me, you know, do you remember the Tongue ad where it was a song, Satisfaction, and it became a big dance hit off the back of the success of the actual TV ad?
Really? Because it was a massive hit in the UK without the Tongue ad.
Well, maybe in Australia. I'm thinking in Australia, in terms of the actual awareness and penetration of that song off the back of the ad, it got quite big. And it's trying to almost emulate that success. I don't know if it's going to work.
But the idea of finding a new band and championing it, I mean, Paul, what do you make of that idea for brands getting involved with that sort of thing?
Well, I think generally when you try and find a new band, you don't. You know, the best new bands come up organically. You know, any competition to find a band is normally doomed to failure. So I think fundamentally wrong strategy, mistake.
Well, on that...
You heard it here first. Whoa,
destroyed. On that painfully negative note, that's where we have to leave it. Thank you to my co-hosts as ever, Camille Alacorn and Scott Rohde.
Thanks, Tim.
And also to Paul Robinson, friend of the podcast, for joining us again.
Thank you.
And also to CBS Interactive for use of their studio. Production was by Georgina Pearson. That was the Mumbrella Podcast. I'm Tim Burrows.